criminal justice system here in Oregon. That's Prison Pipeline, March 21st at 6:30 p.m.
What happens when Oz and Wonderland collide in a twisted brain of a mad composer? A freaking musical, of course. KBOO is proud to present Nick T. Devlin's new musical, Alice Trippin' Sixes. It's a strange and unusual music odyssey. Flying monkeys, scarecrows, jokers, and even midday tokers. Oh, this ain't your normal musical, man. It's a far-out psychedelic trip into the mind of the mad. This is going to be one wild and crazy musical event. Alice Trippin' Sixes, Thursday, March 31st at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio has been broadcasting in Portland since 1968. Not only do we provide thought-provoking news, live performance, and excellent music, we provide broadcast training and access. We are asking you to help us celebrate KBOO by joining us in Willamette Week's Best of Portland poll. Cast your vote during the nomination phase from now until March 31st. There are a few categories KBOO fits into, so write us in as often as you can. Also, don't forget to nominate your favorite shows and hosts, too. For more information, including a link to the poll online and category suggestions, go to kboo.fm/BOP2016.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from EcoPlumber, providing sustainable plumbing services to Portland and the metro area, including remodels, repipes, and repair, as well as green projects such as rainwater or graywater harvesting, and alternative materials such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I'm a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 21st Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Jack Metzger about his latest article, Misrepresenting the White Working Class, What the Narrating Class Gets Wrong. Jack Metzger is a teacher and a writer. In this piece, he explores the politics of the working class. The Trump vote today is attributed to working class backwardness and racism, but in fact, Trump does better with college grads and the rich than he does with working people. Joe Clement reads from Andrew Sayre's 2015 book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich. This excerpt offers a politically conscious interpretation of the term investment in everyday discussions of economic matters. Sayre's distinguishes between object-focused investment, which actually aims at the production of useful goods and services, and financialized investor-focused definitions of investment that are about extracting money. Mara Zussman reads from Sarah Schulman's 2012 book, The Gentrification of the Mind, resonating, of course, with much of what's happening in Portland around housing issues. Bill Resnick will conclude the show with a talk with Michael Shannon of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, with both the Donald and Bernie gaining considerable success attacking U.S. trade policy. Is the TPP, Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, in jeopardy? An invitation for fair trade movement to promote its alternative? I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. And thanks to KABU members, old and new, for supporting KABU programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour, 20 years and counting. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU's own website, kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Jack Metzger.
Hi, Jack Metzger. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill. Good to talk to you.
Jack Metzger is a stalwart for the working class. He's a teacher, taught at Roosevelt University. He's an activist. His latest book, Striking Steel, Solidarity Remembered, it's partly about his own early years and his father, who was a union shop steward at U.S. Steel when that company was still alive and thriving and huge. His father was committed to the union. Striking Steel shows us how much this country owes to mid-century's industrial unions and the people like Jack's father. Jack Metzger recently wrote an article that got some attention. It's titled, Misrepresenting the White Working Class, What the Narrating Class Gets Wrong. We'll be talking today about what I call a deficiency portrait of working people. It's a class prejudice. It infects all media, in fact. It's very obvious when you see it. And it's not just the reporters, but comedians and sitcoms and even serious fiction indulges in the class deficiency portrait. Jack Metzger, tell us about one most excellent example of class prejudice today, which is how the pundits and analysts are discussing Donald Trump's attraction to some Republican voters.
My view is that stereotyping is pretty typically, almost always, where you take a part and act like it's the whole. And what's happening with the analysis of Trump voters, and it's grown just crazy this last couple months, is that there is a portion of the white working class, particularly male, that are Trump supporters. And then the media assumes that that's his base of support. And you would think, since there's a clear definition, the way political pundits do this, if you have less than a bachelor's degree and you're white, you're working class. If you have a bachelor's degree or more and you're white, you're middle class. So there's a clear binary. And the Trump voters are talked about as if they're all white working class, which they're not. Bernie Sanders voters, he gets a lot of white working class by that definition, voters as well, but you never, or almost never, get that number. And the effect of it is that middle class writers, journalists, media, very often university professors, and as you say, you know, popular culture, envision the white middle class as non-racist, non-homophobic, non-anti-feminist, and all of the bad things, all the bigotry and intolerance resides in the white working class. It's a stereotype.
Yeah, in the Trump situation, it is so clear that, in fact, he is not the favorite of the white working class, but a greater proportion of his voters are educated, at least, that is, have college degree, than, in fact, the population has, right?
It's tricky, Bill, because there are numbers that show that from 45% to 55% of Trump voters, sometimes a majority, are white working class, that is, whites without bachelor's degrees. But let's say they're 55%. That's the one I use in the blog. They're 55%. Therefore, they're a majority of Trump supporters in a given situation. But they're 70% of the population. So they're underrepresented. And the white middle class, people with college degree or bachelor's degrees or above, they're overrepresented. And that's what's misunderstood. And it's kind of a tricky statistical thing, but in other instances, we understand overrepresented and underrepresented. In this one, no.
There's a higher percentage of Trump voters are college educated than their percentage in the population.
That's right. That's right.
And calling, therefore, Trump the favorite of the trailer trash, which is another derogatory term often used, or white trash, calling Trump the darling of the white trash is completely false, in that a much larger percentage of Trump voters are educated than their representation in the population.
That's right.
Tell us why that portrait of sort of white trash, bigotry, prejudice, anti-immigration, how does that arise when, in fact, In so many places, we see that a lot of it comes from conservative people with educations and money who, in fact, trigger some of those responses.
Well, there's two strains. One is a conservative strain, that, and some of that proudly embraces and exaggerates the voice of the white working class. And it's true for a part of the white working class. But I think more important is liberal, moderate to liberal, or generally socially liberal, middle class, educated whites, who really among their own groups, whether they're university professors or journalists, are socially enlightened. You know, they'd never use racial epithets, they'd never tell a racial joke, they'd never make fun of gays, etc. And so they think all white people, white people with educations, are like them. So it's just sort of a narrowness in their own experience. I also think there's that tricky statistical thing that's just a misunderstanding, a mistake. But deeper than that, whether this is conscious or not, is that most institutional racism, institutional homophobism, and anti-women legislation and practices, etc., are enforced by whites with bachelor's degrees or better. And so institutional racism actually benefits white middle-class people like me. Not calling attention to that and putting bigotry all in the white working class, it actually serves our interests as a class.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm talking to Jack Metzger, who's been a lifetime fighter for working class people. He's also a writer, did a wonderful book, Striking Steel, Solidarity Remembered, really about his father and the great debt the U.S., all of us, owe to the industrial working class of the mid-century, who basically made the U.S. today, made it relatively egalitarian. Much of that, unfortunately, has disappeared. Jack, let's talk about some other instances of blaming working class people. I read a book years ago, Who Voted for Hitler, by Richard Hamilton. He pointed out that a lot of social scientists, at least the whole theory of working class authoritarianism, came out of the German experience and the rise of Hitler. And they attributed Hitler's rise to working class people who were suffering in the German recession, had their terrible hunger and unemployment after World War I in Germany for quite a long time because of the reparations Germany was paying to the winning side, including the U.S. and England, huge reparations, prostrated Germany. Working class people were in deep trouble. And sort of the intellectuals thought that Hitler's vote came from working people. Well, it turns out, of course, when Hamilton looked at all the voting statistics, and the Germans keep statistics, it was in fact conservatives, it was the religious, it was parts of the very conservative peasantry, it was small business, that Hitler won votes from many of the educated. Hitler's victory was not from the working class. It was from conservatives, rich people, and very conservative religious, mostly Protestants. It seems to me that that's very typical, actually, this blaming these sort of allegedly bigoted and often white trash, undisciplined, lazy working people for racism and homophobia. And it happens now in the United States. Why don't you comment on that?
Hitler got his primary vote from that Hamilton book, which I looked up after you mentioned it, came from the wealthy districts. And that counters so much of all the Frankfurt School and Seymour Martin Lipset and all of that, which sometimes, you know, the debate was it the working class or was it the lower middle class? And then how do you define those two? And it's clear he had a strong, Hitler and the Nazis had a strong base among small business people. But what Hamilton showed, evidently, is how much of the vote came from the wealthier districts, which were traditionalist and conservative and religious, particularly in the East, in the Protestant parts of Germany. But that idea that Nazis came from the working class, the German working class, which is totally false. They were much more communist, likely to be communists and social democrats. That idea just goes on and on and on, despite Hamilton's and other work.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Jack Metzger. We're discussing class prejudice, which is everywhere, and it's hardly even questioned, particularly by the same liberals who write, who would never utter a racist or homophobic phrase, but who are quite able to, for example, attribute the Trump phenomena to working class white trash, some combination of the working class and the lower working class, when in fact even the sort of the numbers that they can look at show that the Trump phenomena has more educated voters than their percent in the population. You know, there's so many examples of that. Let me give you another one. You can talk about it. You know, there's a hitting of children issue. This is just in social science. But it's studied. It's very highly studied. And what they find, of course, is, and what they found since the 60s, is hitting of children and the intensity of the hitting and the devices that they hit with. In fact, nobody uses brushes or sticks or whips or anything anymore, whereas they used to, actually, before the rising of the left after World War II in mid-century. All of it promoted by physicians who wanted the working class to discipline their children. In any event, they look at spanking of children, and what they found, of course, is that working class people hit their children a little bit more than upper class people report that they're touching their children.
Right.
But what they don't say is that there's so much less of it now. There's so much less hitting, and not only less hitting, but it's usually just with the hand and a patch rather than a brush or a belt. And it happened cross-class. And like working people somehow are just seeing, the report you get from social scientists is that working classes are brutal, because they patch their kid a little bit more on self-report studies. It's such a wrong way of looking at the world and understanding things.
It is, and I did a lot of teaching over 30 years where we discussed this subject. Working class people in general, all colors now, are more likely to defend spanking and talk about the value of spanking and the various rules within spanking. And that's spanking. That's not hitting. That's not impulsive hitting. That's using physical pain to discipline children. That doesn't mean that they're more likely to do it. And the rules of spanking very often are, when people justify it, very often complex and defensible. Whereas a kind of a professional middle class ban on any hitting is seen as, you know, terrible and totally unjustifiable. And yet actual hitting that isn't spanking is hitting, which is much more damaging to children. That happens, but very much underreported. And you have all the same problems in terms of social scientists. Working class people, I don't know this, it's not a scientific fact, but my inclination is to think that working class people are much more likely to report, to say things that middle class people feel but would know better than to ever tell a social scientist.
In fact, when they see that behavior, when they get fed up and patch the kid maybe a little bit too hard, they see it as so aberrant that it really doesn't represent their higher and finer qualities as compared to these other people. It seems to me that's very common.
Yeah, my thing is not to beat up on professional middle class, and specifically what Nadine Hubbs calls the narrating class, that is professors, journalists, people who are attempting to understand the world. My thing is that by not reflecting on our own class position and understanding that that affects the way we're likely to see the world, middle-class professionals, mostly I'm talking about liberals and progressives, don't see the way we're reflecting our own class position in ways that cause us to misunderstand and to really stereotype in ways that are vicious and that are self-supporting of our own class position and self-esteem. That's what I'm trying to point.
Jack Metzger, let's talk about the cost of that class prejudice. You mentioned it earlier. What it does is it takes the banks and the employers and the social service agencies and even
every institution,
schools, hospitals, blacks always get worse treatment.
Right.
Every study made, blacks and whites with absolutely similar appearances and medical problems, blacks get less and poorer treatment based on whatever the state-of-the-art standards. But it lets them off the hook. It's sort of, oh, racism isn't a matter of bank lending and redlining, or in fact just these unconscious prejudices that happen in hospital emergency rooms and other places.
Right.
It's racism in this society and homophobia, anti-immigrant ideas, that all comes out of the working class. And the people in these middle-class institutions run by professionals, they sort of get a free ride and really not challenged.
No, that's right. And that comes out in the way our political discussion is occurring now and has been over the last three or four elections, particularly with Barack Obama. One thing I want to point out in terms of the politics is how important the white working class is to the Obama coalition. And this is misunderstood. Now, a majority of whites, regardless of their class, regardless of their religion, except, well, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, age, etc., the majority of whites vote for Republican. They just do. And that means white working class votes majority Republican. But about 40% of white working class, defined by lacking a bachelor's degree and being white, is strongly Democratic. So to have a strong progressive Democrat like Bernie Sanders or even Hillary Clinton, they've got to get 40% of that white working class vote, and they're very likely to get it because a very large portion of the white working class is at least Democrats and very often on certain issues like trade, more progressive than the Democrats.
One final thing, Jack Metzger. It seems to me this deficiency vision of the working class and the working poor, and also, of course, of the non-working people and the unemployed and the people near bottom, that deficiency vision contributes to, it seems to me, right-wing attacks on all popular working class organizations, including especially, of course, the unions. And the line goes, and it's getting more visible, the unions, in fact, just support, especially with regard, let's say, to the schools, the unions support lazy and incompetent workers. And that's their real impact on the economy, and that's why we have to destroy the unions so that we, in fact, get the best and the brightest and the most energetic and highest productive people at work, rather than protecting lazy good-for-nothings.
And that particularly resonates among achievement-oriented middle class of all colors, but particularly among whites. You know, when you call deficiency culture, this is a typical way that educated middle class people and universities purvey this notion. Look at all working class people, which is the vast majority of people in this society, as having a deficient culture. And that deficient culture is, they see, as the lack of a university education. So that is a prejudice that makes it impossible, makes it very difficult for educated, college-educated people to understand the value, the values, and the integrity and the coherence of working-class culture, which operates, like any culture, on different emphases of values and norms and plain-spokenness and authenticity and all kinds of things that are highly valuable if middle-class people within our culture understood that there is a culture different than ours and has values and advantages that ours doesn't have, even though ours is fine, too.
Jack Metzger, so good to talk to you. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Okay, good to talk to you, Bill. Thanks.
Right. So long.
Why is it that civilized humanity can make the world so wrong? This hurly-burly of insanity, our dreams cannot last long. We've reached a deadline, a press headline. Every sorrow, blues value is news value. Tomorrow.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morse, your host this morning, and Joe Clement is our engineer. You just heard Marianne Faithfull with 20th Century Blues. Later in the program, we'll hear Bill Resnick talk with Michael Shannon. He's executive director of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. They'll talk about the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, the fair trade movement, and its alternatives to the current U.S. trade policy. We'll also hear from Mara Zussman. She's reading from Sarah Shulman's 2012 book, The Gentrification of the Mind. Next up, we have Joe Clement. He will talk about Andrew Sayer's 2015 book, We Can't Afford the Rich. Joe?
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. You may remember that late last year, HGTV, the Home and Garden TV network, was going to host a seminar on house flipping in the Portland area. This was part of its TV show Flip or Flop. But because of protest over social media about the insensitivity of hosting such an event in a city going through a housing crisis, the network canceled the event. One of the key terms of this housing boom, which draws the likes of HGTV as well as tech startups from San Francisco looking to flip millions of dollars worth of housing, is investment. I'd like to turn to a book by Andrew Sayer that came out last year called Why We Can't Afford the Rich. It is a very comprehensive and penetrating analysis of wealth inequality and the institutions of extraction and profit and exploitation that underpin it. Turning to investment, Sayer writes, "Investment is surely a good thing. The word has a halo. We need to invest for the future. For training people, for building better infrastructure and communications networks, for improving technology and so on. In these cases, investment involves the provision of resources that enable the production of goods and services or the development of skills that wouldn't otherwise exist. But this honorific term is arguably the most dangerously ambiguous word in our economic vocabulary, at least in camouflaging the sources of wealth. It's often used for quite different practices from the above, such as lending money to others at interest, or buying existing assets like property, gold, works of art, or shares in the hope that their price will rise. Two quite different concepts of investment are involved here. The first one, object-focused definitions. These focus on what people or organizations invest in, for example, infrastructure, equipment, or people, and its usefulness and benefit in the future. A school, or a wind farm, or a railway, or a training program can provide long-term benefits by increasing our capacities. They enable the production of new goods, services, and skills, things with useful qualities or use values in the language of political economy. A better teaching environment, a cleaner source of energy, a better means of travel, a more skilled workforce, and so on. Or it might involve repairing or replacing worn-out equipment. These are examples of what we might call real or objective investment. The second, investor-focused definitions. These focus on the financial gains to the investor from any kind of spending, lending, saving, purchase of financial assets, or speculation, regardless of whether they contribute to any objective investment or provide anything socially useful. In other words, instead of focusing on the benefits of the investment in terms of use values, the focus is on how much money it yields to the investor. The financial sector uses the term investment mainly in this sense, because it is largely indifferent to where its money comes from. $1 million derived from an objective investment is no different from $1 million obtained as interest on a loan or through stock market speculation. Money is money and masks all such critical distinctions. As long as there's a good chance of it bringing a financial return, then gambling, including gambling with other people's money, gets called investment. A toll booth set up on a bridge for extracting money out of the bridge's users could, in contemporary economic parlance, be called an investment for the owners, even though the bridge already existed and no maintenance or improvements were made by the toll booth owners. Why does this matter? because using the same word for different things allows people to mistake wealth extraction for wealth creation. The first meaning of investment refers to attempts to create wealth, the second to attempts to extract it. This indifference as to whether individuals or institutions are funding genuine investment or merely vehicles for providing money for the investor is a major irrationality of capitalism, and the way we use the word investment helps to conceal it. There is no necessary link between the practices identified by these two usages of the term. While you might get a return on a genuine investment, you might not. Even if it yields you nothing personally, it may still have produced material benefits somewhere, perhaps a hospital at the other end of the country that you'll never need. You might even lose money on it, but it could still be an investment in the first sense if it brings benefits to someone. Parents may feel the effort they put into bringing up their children is like this. From the point of view of the second definition, such cases would be seen as bad investments. Equally, those usages that focused merely on financial gains can refer to actions that produce no objective investment in anything whatsoever. Indeed, they may, like asset stripping, have negative effects by sacrificing long-term objective investment for short-term gains made from closing down production and selling stuff off. Speculators almost always call themselves investors. Even the feelings associated with these two uses of the word are likely to be different. In the first case, we might experience the satisfaction of having done something productive, whether for ourselves or for others. In the second case, there might be a more self-regarding feeling of having been prudent or clever, and an enjoyment of money. We are smart investors. Yet, investors in this second sense often haven't a clue if any productive investment results from their savings or dealings on financial markets. As long as they get a reasonable return, then why should they care? But of course, it matters for the development of the economy. Banks invite us to think of our assets and savings as our investments, and offer to help us make them work harder for us. This is especially ironic, where things that we used to regard purely in terms of their use, our house as our home, for example, are treated as things we should regard as an investment for the money they can bring in. The rise of the investor-focused usage relative to the object-focused usage reflects the emergence of financialized capitalism, which prioritizes making money out of money instead of the tricky business of organizing people to produce goods and services. It's truly extraordinary that we treat these different things as one and the same without even noticing. Even radical commentators often slide between the two meanings. For those who depend on investment in this second investor-oriented sense, the slippage is a useful source of mystification, including self-mystification. It conceals not only a difference in functions, in how things work, but a moral difference between contributing to the creation of something useful and just getting a return, no matter what. If you just tuned in, I was reading from Andrew Sayer's book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, which is available at the Multnomah County Library. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement.
You never go to nightclubs and you just don't care to dance. You don't have time for silly things like moonlight and romance. You only think of dollar bills tied neatly in a stack. But when you kiss a dollar bill, it doesn't kiss you back. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is listener-supported community radio. I'm with Joe Clement, our engineer this morning. I'm Denise Morris, your host. Stay tuned for the end of the program with Bill Resnick and Michael Shannon of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. They're going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact and alternatives to current U.S. trade policy. Next up, though, we have a debut from Mara Zussman. She is reading from Sarah Schulman's 2012 book, The Gentrification of the Mind. Mara?
My name is Mara Zusman, and I'm reading a few pages from Sarah Shulman's 2012 book, The Gentrification of the Mind, because for me, it captures some of the sadness our community is experiencing around culture loss in the new Portland for the rich. And in light of Hillary Clinton's disturbing attempt to revise AIDS history and erase the courageous acts of civil disobedience that ACT UP activists like Shulman did, I felt even more reason to share this work. Sarah Shulman is a New York City-based writer, professor of English, lesbian social critic, and activist. This book, part history, part memoir, links the plague years of AIDS to the gentrification of New York City. This is from Chapter 4, The Gentrification of Creation. Why do artists move to cities? Because they want to be part of the creation of new ways of thinking. One of the reasons I have always loved being an artist in New York City is that we get to hear some kinds of ideas before they are widely available. We get to invent and hear new approaches as they are rawly, freshly born. And then we get to be part of the development of those ideas through conversations in living rooms, on subways, in the audiences of live presentations and artist studios, looking at works in progress, watching rough cuts of films, hearing workshops of plays and over dinner. By the time the book is written, able to find a publisher, actually printed, possibly distributed, and finally available at the mall, about 2 to 6 years have passed. By the time those books are purchased and finally read, two generations of subsequent newer discoveries have already taken place. But in order for us to gather together for this purpose, certain preconditions are required. 1. Affordable places for unrecognized practitioners to live, have workspace, and find time to make their work. 2. Diversity of thought and experience that produces a dynamic, mutual exposure to varied points of view. 3. Stimulation, unlimited raw material. 4. Some kind of pleasure and difference. 5. Regular, direct access to great artists and their work. Under gentrification, what is possible for young artists, hence how they see themselves, is dramatically different. They cannot afford to live or work. They are faced with conformity of aesthetics and values in their neighborhoods. Conventional bourgeois behavior becomes a requirement for surviving socially, developing professionally, and earning a living. By necessity, their goals are altered. Reimagining the world becomes far more difficult, and reflecting back what power brokers and institutional administrators think about themselves feels essential to survival. This is a much more difficult environment in which to imagine oneself as an artist, negotiate the expense of art making, and, most challenging of all, to be allowed by the tight fist of the prevailing institutions to emerge without losing one's soul. There seems to be no other game in town right now. I believe, of course, that this can, will, and must change, but that would only be possible with consciousness. And so I want to talk about how gentrification and AIDS have created the loss and replacement of the community-based artist who responds to people and their aesthetic complexities instead of to power institutions. People also move to cities to invent new political movements. Gay liberation, like all explosive visions that transform the world of possibility, required urbanity. It was not born in Scarsdale, Levittown, Syosset, or Great Neck. It required freedom, oppositionality, imagination, rebellion, and interaction with difference. In order for radical queer culture to thrive, there must be diverse, dynamic cities in which we can hide, flaunt, learn, influence, in which there is room for variation and discovery. If people who are not wealthy are going to become artists and revolutionaries, they need affordable rents and workspaces, ways to learn their craft without paying tuitions, and a process of development that is not systematized. They need ways of being seen and helped by those in power behind the scenes without having to be professionalized facsimiles to get help. Most importantly, real artists, people who invent instead of replicate, need counterculture as a playing field. Most plays that get produced these days are kind of like live TV. If they involve complex social dynamics, they usually argue, in the end, that people are resilient and good prevails after all. But most often, rewarded plays involve the small concerns of recognizable bourgeois types and may have some formal innovation for their own sake. I've experienced two talented theater directors telling me explicitly that they don't care about what a play is saying or what happens in a play, they only are interested in how it says it. But formal invention is not inherently progressive. As we have learned from video clips, computer graphics, and sampling, formal invention has a radical purpose when used to convey unconventional points of view, that is to say, when it is used to expand what is conveyed about human experience. Even though many heterosexuals avoid the fate, destiny of romance, marriage, parenthood, it is a well-worn and instantly recognizable structure upon which most mainstream representations are based. In other words, most bourgeois straight people already know the storyline of their lives they're supposed to follow before their lives are even begun. For pre-assimilation queers, this was not the case. Our lives were strangely structured, singular works without predetermination, unknown stories that had never before been heard. The dominant culture told us we were outcasts and alone, and then did everything they could to make that come true. Out of the conflict between our determination to truly exist fully as ourselves and our clash with highly propagandized false stories and even more powerful silences came queer culture, the marvel that produced many of the great art ideas of the 20th century. The artful AIDS dead, of course, included some very successful and high-earning celebrity artists like Keith Haring and Robert Mapplethorpe, but the vast majority were rank-and-file artists who didn't live long enough to become known or to quit or to become teachers or heads of institutions. They didn't live long enough to influence. I could list names like Gordon Curti, Brian Taylor, John Sex, Huck Schneider, Paul Walker, there were two of them, Harry Whittaker Shepherd, and on forever. But what would be the point? Since many of them worked before video was a regular part of life, there is little documentation of what they did. In a sense, they only live on in the memories of the living. Penny Arcade's brilliant play, Invitation to the End of the World, featured a heartbreaking scene in which Penny imagines the mother of Rita Redd, a drag artist who died of AIDS, standing on a street corner in the East Village, stopping passers-by and asking if they had ever heard of her son. "He did shows," she insists. "He put on lots of shows." She can't understand why none of the recent yuppie arrivals know who he was. She doesn't realize that his audience has also died. These dead and their friends pioneered new art ideas, including performance, installation, the intersection of new technologies and live performance, improvisational new music and improvisational dance, drag, expansions of materials and techniques. They came to New York or grew up in New York and lived in low-income areas, hustled legally and illegally for a living, made art for low-income audiences, and had an interactive relationship with urban life. They did not live long enough to be able to object to the professionalization of the arts, which might not have been so thorough had they lived. They did not mature. When they died, their practice of creating new paradigms outside of institutional structures was removed from sight. My name is Mara for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been reading from Sarah Schulman's book, The Gentrification of the Mind. For more, check out your local bookseller or borrow The Gentrification of the Mind from your local public library, as I did.
Some fools don't know what's right from wrong, but somehow those folks belong. Me, I try for all I'm worth, but I still remain a stranger on this earth. Some people gloom, other folk cry.
That was Marianne Faithfull with Stranger on This Earth, and thanks to Mara Zussman for her debut here on The Old Mole. We'll hope to hear more from her in the future. Next up, we have Bill Resnick and Michael Shannon, and they're going to talk about fair trade, free trade, and all that's in between. Michael is with the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, and of course, Bill Resnick is one of our own Old Moles. Bill?
Michael Shannon. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you so much.
Michael Shannon, known as Shannon, The trade wars in the U.S. have heated up, and in the U.S. presidential campaign, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have attacked U.S. international trade policy, and their opponents support it, though Hillary Clinton says what her husband always said. Well, this one is better. We're going to really toughen it up as to the provisions on union protection, on human rights, on protection of the environment. But it always turns out that the few provisions really had no teeth and were completely ignored and non-enforced. One thing that the supposed free trade advocates have going for them is that the establishment media is solidly behind them. So all the networks find nicely dressed expert economists to say trade is only slightly responsible for job loss. In fact, trade is good. It's good for the U.S. and it's good for workers. It's especially good for the U.S. because we have to switch from an industrial to a service and knowledge economy. And they say that over and over. Shannon, tell us the real story.
Well, the real story is, first of all, trade is good when it's done fairly. We have a history of free trade agreements here in the United States that you covered very well, but what I would really emphasize is that they often have protections that are not enforced, or the protections are missing. So even when we've negotiated agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, one of the planks of that was that Mexican workers would begin to have the right to freely organize unions and access collective bargaining. But here we're now, I think, 20 plus years after NAFTA, and most union representation in Mexico is still through state-run unions where workers don't get a democratic voice. So why do we want to expand this across the Pacific Rim with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where we have the same issues of very limited policies to protect workers and the environment and little to no enforceability?
What about the claim that they make that really only a few jobs have been lost to trade, and in fact it's really helped the U.S. economy because we get all of these cheap goods flowing across the ocean? How do you make for that? I mean, these economists look at the whole picture and they say, oh, it's great for the U.S. We got this.
Well, you know, when our wages haven't gone up in decades, those cheap goods are important to us. But I think we need to be looking at why our wages aren't going up. And part of that is competing with economies that operate on a different scale. If you look at Vietnam, one of the signatories for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, workers there are paid an average of 65 cents a day. And it's basic economic theory that if you ask workers to compete against each other, one of whom is getting paid 65 cents a day and one of whom is getting paid our federal minimum wage, still too low, that's going to drive workers' wages down. And that's what's happened with past free trade agreements, and we're going to see more of it should the Trans-Pacific Partnership be ratified.
Yeah, companies, in fact, that's a major part of their arsenal when they're unionized or non-unionized, to say if you don't accept a job cut or a two-tier or whatever it is, or longer hours or flexible hours, which means much shorter and harder hours, if you don't accept that, we're gone. And not just, of course, to China or Thailand or Mexico or other places. They might be gone to Birmingham, Alabama or something. That's part of their weaponry.
Mm-hmm. And definitely. And one thing, you talk about numbers of jobs lost to trade. The most often numbers you'll hear are workers that have been certified for trade adjustment assistance. Those are workers whose a direct line can be drawn between the loss of their job and trade policy. But looking at a recent closure in Oregon in Newburgh, a paper mill closed down, that these workers now there have been certified for trade adjustment assistance, which is good for them because they are going to be getting some help with retraining as well as unemployment. But you know who's not getting counted in the loss of jobs in Newburgh due to trade? The public sector jobs that are going to have to be cut or go away completely, because that mill was the largest source of tax revenue for the city of Newburgh. So these job losses from trade have ripple effects that are often not counted as public revenue goes down, public workers lose their jobs, and we lose access to public services.
Yeah, another argument that they make, I got this one, I watched a few TV programs who are featuring now trade, defending, quote, free trade, which isn't free. We'll get to that. It's highly managed. They defend trade, though, with this sort of internationalist vision that, yes, we've lost a few jobs, but we will retrain people for all the great jobs that the high tech is producing for us. That's a good one. But remember, jobs are being created in China and Thailand and Mexico. Isn't that wonderful? We should be leading the world and bringing up the standard of living for the people in all of these impoverished impoverished countries. What do you make of that one?
Well, we should be doing that. And yes. One of the ways would be to come up with a fair trade agreement that includes enforceable protections for workers, enforceable protections for the environment. One interesting point about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is progress, albeit a very tiny little step, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership does require that all member countries have a minimum wage. It doesn't require a number. It doesn't require an equation. It simply requires that a minimum wage is set. So that minimum wage could be set at 65 cents an hour, and that would be fulfilling the obligations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah, it could be set at 65 cents an hour. It also could be set at $10 an hour or $20 an hour, but the company would turn around and then charge for the lodging they provide and the food they provide and maybe a walk in the park for $5. It seems to me that minimum wages are around the world. The countries that have them they're just not enforced. And also, the companies dodge them through all of these tricks. It would be good to have a real minimum wage, but it would have to be under a whole different set of circumstances.
It would. And I would, however, come back to the idea of maybe we can't put a number in a trade agreement like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but we could certainly put a cost of living equation together that would be able to be used across economies so that workers are not being exploited for their labor and rather being paid a living wage for the economy that they live in.
You know, one of the things that Diana said at your rally this morning, which was very successful, she pointed out that Diana of Jobs with Justice, she pointed out that in Mexico, yes, there were some industrial jobs created, ones that fled the United States, but also the subsidized corn that flooded Mexico cost the jobs of 3, 4, or 5 million people had to leave the land and leave their homes when their corn crops, which of course devastated the countryside, but also meant that Mexico City is probably the largest city in the world, but no one can count all of the people who have fled there. You know, the plains outside of Mexico City now are all favelas, basically. It does create some industrial jobs, but it creates more poverty because it so dislocates all of the small producers in the society that we are now creating in the image of the Western powers, which is big cities supported by big industries somehow and mass production. But it doesn't work, though. It works very slowly, if at all, because their wages never rise. People are in the informal economy. It's been terrible for Mexico. It just makes the wealthy of Mexico that has many, many multi-billionaires now. But it's terrible for the poor people, for the average person in Mexico. Anyway.
Well, and you're exactly right. It's working for the people who wrote it. And that's true of NAFTA, which is law, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is yet to be ratified. And that's because who was at the table? Fossil fuel industries, big pharma, agribusiness, the big corporations were writing these trade agreements. And so, yes, they get the benefits that they negotiated, but those benefits, as we all know, do not trickle down. They stay with the 1%. And that is one of the biggest problems with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is it is a trade pact written by corporations for corporations. It will create capital, but who will hold that capital? The 1% and multinational corporations.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here talking to Michael Shannon, who's the executive director of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. They, of course, call it free trade. It's not free trade at all. How many pages in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement? I mean, it's loaded with provisions.
And
It's managed trade, but yeah.
And it's, and go back to who's managing the trade. Is it for the public good? Is it for our climate? Is it for the workers that are create or manufacturing the products that we wish to consume? No, it's for the owners. It's for the 1%. It's for the multinational corporations. So it is very much working for those who wrote it. But when it comes to free trade, you know, one of the things that you'll hear a lot of the arguments coming out of the White House is that we're cutting tariffs. And it's great because that's going to remove barriers to goods moving across borders. However, why are we cutting tariffs on ivory in the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Why are we cutting tariffs on whale meat in the Trans-Pacific Partnership? These tariffs are there to de-incentivize these products, but yet now we've got our White House advocating for the removal of tariffs that will actually increase endangered species trade. And on the tariff front, there's another thing. It's free. There's no more tariffs. But if you look at the 18,000 tariff cuts, and you'll hear that number a lot from the White House about how wonderful the TPP is, over half of those tariff cuts are on products that we here in the United States do not make. And so those tariff cuts will not impact our economy either way. But they love that 18,000 tax cut number.
The other side, Michael, Shannon, the free traders call us protectionists. That is, all we want to do is put tariffs on and keep other goods out and protect inefficient industries. Any industry that pays its workers a living wage is by definition inefficient, of course, according to the hedge funds and the private equity funds and the others who, and the other big ownership, and the pension funds, actually, who contribute to that unbalanced and predatory economy. Donald Trump actually does talk about raising tariffs and is vocally protectionist. The Fair Trade Campaign is not. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by fair trade. How would fair trade be managed?
Well, I'm going to start with economist by the name of Stiglitz, I can't remember his first name at the moment, Nobel Award winning economist, talked about what would a progressive trade agreement look like, because that's something that President Obama has called the TPP. And he talks about the investor-state dispute settlement system where corporations can sue countries for trade barriers or diminishing their expected future profits. There is no rights for labor groups or environmental groups or other non-governmental organizations to file suit for violations of our climate, violations of workers' rights. So that is one way that I would say we advocate for fair trade, is to make sure that all the players are at the table that are looking out for the public good in addition to the corporations, because as long as we have corporations at the table, they're going to be writing free trade agreements, which means freedom for them to sell their product at the lowest possible price and pay the least amount possible to make it.
You know, that those are you know, excellent ideas, although the amount of litigation would get to be absolutely enormous. And maybe it's good to have a society of half lawyers fighting one another. Well, it keeps them active, right? And lawyers used to make a lot of money. Now there are too many of them, so there are a lot of kids get law degrees and are working as baristas, but that's another matter. It seems to me the final, what we really need is a guaranteed annual wage, not just a minimum wage, but a guaranteed annual income, so that people don't get destroyed when a company moves out or when somebody gets sick or all of the rest of it. And I think we have to look at that as a good part of the answer to trade, where people around the world and in the United States can have a secure future. And you have the last word, Michael, for about 30 seconds.
Well, we just need to keep up the pressure on Congress to make sure that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not ratified. We can do that through phone calls, emails, letters, participating in actions like the one this morning. You can find Oregon Fair Trade on Facebook, Twitter, and info@OregonFairTrade.org is our email.
Thank you, Michael Shannon.
All right. Thanks both Bill Resnick and Michael Shannon. There's more to come on KBOO at 10 o'clock. It's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. Locus Focus is 10:15. Host Barbara Bernstein talks with philosophy professor Adam Briggle about fracking. At 11, Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. His guest, Dr. Maya Shetreat Klein, author of the book The Dirt Cure, and that's about children's health. At 11:30, Monday morning, Radio Zine, Quilter Wind Dyer, I may have just butchered that, but her quilts made from tarps and the people that benefit from them. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's a collective labor, of course, that brings you the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m., and we thank you for listening, and you will hear us again next week.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passenart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. Smoldering Fires explores how to apply the ideas and struggles of the civil rights movement to contemporary city life through the point of view of two young friends who differ in temperament and approach. Again, that's Smoldering Fires, March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 Northeast Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.